Before we begin, I just want to introduce her by Jay Kelman for a minute, if he has something you want to say to our group. And then I'm going to talk about the trips for a second, and then we're going to get right into it. So, Rabbi Kelman.
Hello, hi, can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. We can hear. Do you
I
want to say
just want to
something?
welcome. Yeah, can you hear me? I
Yes.
am speaking. I don't know if you can hear me. I just want to welcome
Yes, we can hear
everybody
you.
and looking forward to another great series. This is our 176th class of this really fascinating series covering an extremely wide range of gedolim, rabbis, leaders, and I heartily encourage everybody to listen to some of the past lectures, and we look forward to a great series on Rav Aaron Cutler, and I want to thank you all for joining us, and sit back and enjoy. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Kelman. I just want to give Rabbi Kelman a shout out because he really started using this technology before anyone else had. As he mentioned, we've had 175 prior classes. I actually thought it was 174. Okay, 175. You can download them all on the website. You can become a monthly member where it's very inexpensive and download 30. We already did. I mean, this is going in an order. For those who've never been with us, at the end, you can always send questions into me at the bottom there, and I'll stop every now and then and deal with the questions. And at the end, I will deal with questions as well. I also have. It's been a while since we last met, so I have a number of comments and questions from people who listen because most people who listen to these classes, and there are many, do not listen live. And they send questions, and those who've been with us in the past know that I deal with a lot of these questions and comments at other times as well. In fact, some people have heard all the classes. But this semester, and before we even start, one more thing. I'm going to remove this, but first take a look. The Jewish history, the trips through Jewish history. If you enjoy these classes, you will very much enjoy our summer Jewish history trips. Greece, Italy, and Spain. I actually have to say that Greece is sold out with over 40 people, but there's still room on Italy and Spain. So we'd like to welcome anyone who wants to join. You can certainly contact me if you want more information. And without any further ado, let me pull up a picture of the great Rav Aaron Cutler. Okay. We're set for six classes. We'll see how long it takes. I don't think it'll take less. Sometimes they take more. But we started with Rav Aaron Cutler at the end of the last class doing with Rav Charlap, but I think we have to go back because we have new people and it's a new semester. So let me just begin by saying that when we come to Rav Aaron Cutler, we're dealing with someone who had an enormous impact on the United States and even on the world. I don't know about Israel. I mean, you have to imagine if someone wasn't around, how things would have existed. I can't really say that he had a significant influence on the development in Israel, but certainly in America and also in Europe. I was in Mexico a few months ago for Shabbos, and I can tell you that his influence in Mexico is very strong because not only in the past, many of the rabbis in Mexico now are students of Lakewood. They even to this very day, people are brought up to Lakewood. They have Shabbos. Tones and weeks where people from Mexico, the Sephardi, because it's a Syrian community mostly, come to Lakewood. So we're dealing with someone with enormous impact. As we will see, however, he also had an impact in Europe. He was an influential figure, not like he was in America, but and views that even were regarded as really out of the mainstream in Europe, a more extreme, as we'll see. But he really becomes important in America after World War II. And I do think, and I've said this a number of times, that if you look at the three most important rabbinic figures in America in the post-World War II years, I think you have to have Rav Aaron Cutler. I mean, the whole yeshiva movement as we know it is really due to his influence. If you look at the yeshivas, and we'll talk about this as we go through the semester, we're gonna see how he was able to achieve this. But just to anticipate, if you would look at what the yeshivas, and there were yeshivas, Chaim Berlin, Torah Vadas, others, if you look at what they were like in the years before World War II, and the really even the first decades after World War II, and compare them today, there's enormous influence. It was the idea that you're supposed to go to university at night. I mean, this was regarded as standard in those yeshivas. And so out of Lakewood, There's been an enormous change, and this really, so Revara and Cutler, the whole Lakewood Colwells, the Kirov Colwells, really the change in American Orthodoxy for a variety of ways that we will see. So let me just say that, and then I'll try to prove why I believe this. And the second of the three important is, of course, Rabbi Soloveitchik. The whole ethos of American modern Orthodoxy has been influenced to such an impact by him. And the third most important would be the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And with all three of these, we see that certainly with Rav Soloveitchik and Revara and Cutler, a great deal, most of their influence, I think you might even be said, certainly with Revara and even with the Rav also, after their passing. Rav Soloveitchik is more influential now than he was in his lifetime. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, although he was very influential in his lifetime, his influence has even grown after his death. And as I said, to show how influential someone is, try to imagine them out of the picture. If there never was a Rav Aaron Cutler, a Lubavitcher Rebbe, or a Soloveitchik, how would Orthodoxy today look? Now, most of what we see when we speak about influence is posthumous. It's after Rav Aaron's passing. However, with many great people, they set in motion things that move after their death. In fact, when he passed away, we're told that the yeshiva had something like 200 students. And now, not only are there thousands, the whole city, the whole city of Lakewood is, it's really so much of it has nothing to do per se with the yeshiva, but it's built a whole city that would have been unimaginable without the yeshiva. And as I said, we'll see where the yeshiva comes from, how it arrives in Lakewood, etc. So let me begin with his biography. Those who've been with us before know that we first focus on the biography and then focus on the influence and the writings. And Rav Aaron's biography will take us through so many important events of the 20th century. And Meiselman, I'll get to all the comments and questions later. I'll take breaks or towards the end. But keep writing, and then at the end we'll do it. He's born in 1892. Already, if you know when he lived to, you see he did not live a very long life. But he's born in 1892 in a place in Lithuania, a little shtetl, it's called. And his father was actually the Rav of the town. His father's name is Shneur Zalman. It's not a Chabadnik, but his name is Shneur Zalman. But the last name is Pinnes. Today we would write it as, you might spell it as Pines, Pines. And there, it's a well-known family in Europe. There was a, I assume they're all related. In Switzerland, there was a Talmud Chacham, and you have Pines in America, not far from where I live in New Jersey. There's a family named Pines. So the father is Pines, and Rav Aaron Cutler. In fact, Rav Aaron Cutler, we have a Mazel Tov given to him on in one of the early Hebrew newspapers, and it refers to him as the name as Pines, Pines or Pinnes. So he still used that early on. And some of you might be thinking of the great scholar of Jewish philosophy, Shlomo Pinnes. As far as I know, there's no relation, but maybe there is. So then, where does the name Cutler come from? And there are other Cutlers in Europe who are not related to Rav Aaron Cutler. We dealt with one in a previous semester who comes to America as a rabbi here. Well, in discussing Rav Aaron Cutler, there's really a few basic sources. In addition to academic articles, there's been in the last 5 years a number of academic articles, including in the new book that came out last year on the Gedolim. I'll show you the picture of that book later on. But we also have a hagiography, two volumes. It hasn't translated to English. It's called Eish HaTorah by Aaron Sorosky. He's a well-known Haredi writer of hagiographies. From 2000, the book appeared in 2013. And as with all these books, it has to be used carefully. But the facts are usually correct. We'll see some problems with some of the facts, but at least the basic biographical facts we won't have so many problems with. There'll be a few. There also is this book, an important book. I have this is an original copy of it. Two volumes. Look how thick this is. Making of a Gadol of Nathan, known as Nassan Kamenetsky. There's a second edition, which maybe is still around, which is the updated. I think it's called the improved edition. But this is the original edition, which today is worth thousands of dollars. It's a collector's item. Sure, most of you know the story of this book, that it was banned, and because it was banned, and there was so much written about it, the book became a collector's item, because the lesson is, whenever you ban something, it then becomes a collector's item. How did I get this? I got it almost by accident. I don't know if I would have got it if I wasn't lucky. At the university where I'm sitting right now, University of Scranton, we have, if you're ever in Northeast Pennsylvania, come to our library. It's full of Jewish books and Sfarim, which I order for the library. And years ago, when the book first came out, 2002, I didn't know Nussan Kamenetsky yet, and I called up Eagle Eyes and asked him to send, they tell me what new books came out, and they tell me about this book by Nussan Kamenetsky, Making of a Gadol. And I thought, it's some hagiography, like an art school hagiography. And I wasn't going to order it, but the man at the store, the son, Aaron Beagle Eisen, if you know the Sfarim store, says I'll enjoy it. So I ordered it for the university. But it's sent to me, I see all the books, and then I give them to the university, and the bill is to the university. And when I get it, immediately, well, the first thing I noticed is pictures of all these rabbis on it, including over here. You should recognize this one if you see that. It comes from the front page cover of my. Here, let me show you. Look where it comes from. It's taken from the front cover of my book on Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. This is the hard cover, but the soft cover as well. So immediately, at first I was a little upset. he had no right to put that picture on. That's the picture which I was given the rights for. I found it at the University of Gießen in Germany. But the fact that he had that picture on it showed me that this was not a typical hagiography. I'll show you later a picture. Well, here it is. I'll talk about this picture a little later. There is Rav Aaron Cutler, looking very dapper, not looking. And I started looking at the book, and I couldn't believe this, that this is a very unusual book. And I immediately contacted a friend of mine, who's well ensconced in the Haredi world, after reading the book for about an hour, and I said, after seeing some of the stories and things I'll tell you, especially about Rav Aaron Cutler, because the book is banned primarily because of what it says about Rav Aaron Cutler. I said, is this book going to be banned? Or is this, right, is he going to be banned, the author? Or will his zechus avos, is the merit of the fact that he's the son of one of the greatest gedolim of our time, Yaakov Kamenetsky, is that going to spare him? And my friend said that, because he had also seen the book, that he will be spared the ban because of his who he is. It turns out my friend was wrong. There was a ban against the book, and there even was at least one Pashkavil against him in person. So I guess that's a ban against him. And I immediately decided I'm going to keep the book. So I paid the library for the book, and I kept it myself. And it has never been reprinted, except for the updated version, which is really a censored, a self-censored version, which he thought that by doing it, by taking out the controversial parts that I'll tell you about, he thought that that would spare the book. No, that book was banned too, the second book. And then he wrote another book, a third one, which is only given to people. If you're in Israel, you can go get it from him. It's only given in person, if he thinks you're worthy, I guess. It's called Anatomy of a Ban, in which he tells the whole story of the ban, and he has all the documents against him. So it's a study of the ban and what happened from his perspective, but all the primary documents, including the ones calling him the worst sort of names. And he asked me what to do with it, because he can't publish it, because then they'll really destroy him. So I said, and he took my advice, to give it to the Hebrew University, and that for 25 years, it will be under lock and key, and then they'll able to let people see it. And anyone who goes to him, if he wants to, he can give it to you. And this book also is kept under lock and key in the rare book room, because they're afraid someone's going to take it and destroy it. So these are the two major sources of Rav Aaron Cutler, as well as other things I have. And already we see a problem, because about the name. Sharosky's book claims that, what does he say? He says the father, Shneur Zalman, Rav Aaron's father, changed the name. In fact, he gave a different name so that he wouldn't be he would be exempt from the draft, because the rule was if you were an only child, you'd be exempt from the draft. And therefore, by giving him this name, and I've heard this from other people as well. I even heard this in my own family. My mother's, I heard this from my late grandmother, something about a name in her family changed for a similar reason. But so that's the story that Sorosky gives. However, and LeVaron Cutler took the name and kept the name. So actually, sorry, it's Schneer Zalman's father changed the name to Cutler for his son. But no, the name, it was only used officially. Privately, everyone used that name. But Rav Aaron took the name Cutler for the similar reason. That's what Sorosky says. The reason I say it's a little problematic, perhaps, is because Kamenetsky, he claims that it was Ravisa Zalman Meltzer that changed the name of his future son-in-law, also for similar reasons, for draft reasons. Who knows? He claims, Kamenetsky claims that this information comes from Rav Aaron Cutler's daughter, Schwartzman. He had a daughter who married a rabbi named Dov Schwartzman, which I would assume would be correct, although Sorosky, everything he writes also comes from the family. So I'm not sure what the answer is there. Now, Schneer Zalman, the father of Aaron Cutler, had, according to Sorosky, this is the sort of thing it shouldn't be difficult to figure out. You can ask the family now. If anyone knows, you can ask. But Sorosky claims two daughters and one son. The reason I say it shouldn't be hard to figure out is because you get a different version in Kamenetsky on how many sons. But one of these daughters, we'll see, becomes quite important because she would help raise Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron's mother dies when Rav Aaron is 4 years old. And she survives the war. See what becomes of her. And there's another daughter who remains religious. As I said, I anticipate we'll see what happens with her. Is married to some, not a Rosh Yeshiva, but a Rav, someone who worked in the Yeshiva world as a Mashgiach of the Yeshiva, a Talmid Chacham who was killed in the war, named Chervakovsky is his name, was involved in the Yeshiva. When Rav Aaron is 11, his father dies. So therefore, the daughter is going to become very important because there are no more parents. He goes to live with an uncle, but being raised by an uncle, you could see that his sister is going to become very important. But he's raised by his uncle. Now, why is he sent to an uncle? Well, I mean, clearly someone needs to raise him. However, it appears that he could have remained in the city where he was. Where his father was the Rav, there are people who would take care of him. At least Kamenetsky, the version he has, is that Rav Aaron's relatives decided that he has to be removed from that city and sent to Minsk with the uncle because his sister, who was doing the lion's share of raising him, she was older than him, she had already become a communist, and they were very worried of her corruptive influence on him from a religious perspective. An influence, a corruptive influence that for the rest of his life she tried to exercise, as we will see. But in order to get him away from her, at least this is the version Kamenetsky has, it had, and for, in fact, he doesn't even say her. He mentions the not just her corruptive influence, but also his two older brothers who Sorosky says don't exist. According to Sorosky, there are no older brothers. There's only two daughters and Rav Aaron, but you can say Sorosky is covering up the fact that he had older brothers. I don't know, because we'll see with Sorosky, he doesn't mention anything about this older sister being irreligious. He turns her into some sort of Sadekus, as we'll see, but he doesn't deny that she exists. So the fact that he might have had two older brothers who were irreligious, I don't think that's reason enough for Sorosky not to have mentioned them. He just turned them into religious Jews. Those who read my book, Changing the Immutable, know that Chabad did this is exactly what Chabad did with one of the Rebbe's, Lubavitcher Rebbe's brothers. Lubavitcher Rebbe had a brother who became completely irreligious. And we're not dealing with ancient history here. He lived in Tel Aviv. He was a public Sabbath violator. His store was open on Shabbos. He smoked on Shabbos, and people today are still alive who remember this. And not only that, he has a daughter who's alive and well, completely irreligious, and yet they turn him into some tzaddik who was an expert in Hasidus. It's really unbelievable. But they don't. So you don't need to deny that he exists. Now, this sister's name was Malka. And as I said, she was a communist sympathizer. She dies in 1969. She outlives Rav Aharon. And she actually is buried in Jerusalem, in Har HaMenuchos, near where Rav Aharon was buried. Rav Aharon always took care of her. Well, let me read you about it. Well, first, let me read you the tombstone. Tombstone, which you can see a picture of this in Sarosky's book. On page 18, it says here is Litmanah is buried. Ha'isha hagdolah v'hatznuah, the great woman and the modest woman. Chachmat lev migezat hashishim v'yirat Hashem hititalal. It says that fear of God is her glory. Marat Malka Pines Cutler. Bas HaGaon is the daughter of the Gaon, Shneur Zalman, the rabbi of Sislevitz. She who raised from his youth in his orph as an orphan, Rav Aharon Cutler. It says she's his brother, and she always was concerned near and far, what would become of him, and therefore she needs to be remembered, her share in the fact that he spread Torah and fear of God in Klal Yisrael and the Jewish people. It's an amazing tombstone because I as you'll see, I have no idea how can she can be given any credit whatsoever for helping spread Torah when everything she wanted was the exact opposite. We know that after people pass away, that you're allowed to in eulogies, you're allowed to actually stretch the truth. Some people hold you can even lie. I guess maybe on tombstones you can as well, but it's completely at odds with the facts as we know them, when not only was she completely irreligious, because there are plenty of irreligious people who give money to yeshivas who themselves are not religious, but they believe in it and they admire. On the contrary, to the end of her life, she thought that her brother was a failure, and that why did he become a Mohammed? And she called it, he could have become a great mathematician. Let me read, I'll present the evidence right now. Well, first, you have Kamenetsky, but so let me read you a little what Kamenetsky has to say. But even without for leaving Kamenetsky aside, here's a book. Here's a Hagia. Here's a book of memories of Rav Aharon Cutler. First-hand stories of Rav Aharon Cutler and his storm over Torah in America, called "The Fire of Torah," Pritzadi Gates Chaim. This is published by Feldheim. This is an example of hagiography. And there's a whole chapter in here that discusses, I'll read you some of it, that discusses his sister. And it's Rav Aharon, despite the fact that his sister would always badmouth what he's doing for a living and had no connection to Torah, he always would come to her at the old age home. She never married, she was a spinster. And he always was, him and his wife were always very solicitous of her and always treated her well. And so, I mean, you get, we're not, I'm not presenting anything that Kamenetsky discovered and is unusual information. This is, as we say in rabbinic Hebrew, even modern Hebrew, I guess, a davar yaduah. It's not secret, hidden information I'm revealing, that his sister was completely not just irreligious, anti-religious. You can even find it, as I said, in the Fire of Torah. But Kamenetsky discusses this a great deal. For those who have the book, for instance, and it's nothing unusual. Let me just, before I tell you what Kamenetsky says, Rabbi Soloveitchik had, there were five members of the Soloveitchik family, his older brother, Shmuel, him, his younger brother, Aaron, and his two sisters. Number of people have pointed out from the Lithuanian rabbinic world that Ramosha Soloveitchik is basically unique, in that he had five children and all remained religious. It's almost unheard of. You can go down the list of great rabbis from Lithuania before the war, and invariably you'll find children who are irreligious, who became communists, who became Zionists. It is almost, I know of no other rabbinic family that you have a situation like you have with Rav Soloveitchik's family. So the fact that Rav Aaron Cutler had a sibling or siblings who were not religious, as I said, that is to be expected. If you look on page 311 and on, that you have stories about Rav Aaron Cutler and his sister. He quotes Chaim Grozovsky about the saintly compassion which Rav Aaron displayed to his sister despite the obstacles she had put in his path in the early years. She was actually a professor of mathematics in Paris. Rav Aaron brought her over to the United States, and she served on the faculty of Columbia University in New York. And then he goes through the stories, he quotes from Fabian Schoenfeld, who used to visit her, different stories. So anyone who has the book can read about it there. Also on pages 327 and on, there are more stories about how she tried to remove Ravaro. Well, it tells an interesting story about how when Rav Aaron was in the yeshiva, Slabodka, we'll talk about this, the mail there used to be censored. And he was getting letters from his sister, and the administration weren't too happy with this. So they took away the mail and these letters. And when Rav Aaron found out about it, he was not very happy, and he decided he was going to leave the yeshiva, but they were able to convince him to stay. So this is all found there. Now, as I mentioned in this book by Rabbi Eliyahu Bean, The Fire of Torah, if you want to check that out, on page 85, you have an interview with Rabbi Solomon B. Shapiro. These are all interviews with people who knew Rav Aaron. And he was the chaplain at Kings County Hospital, and he gets a call from Rav Aaron to go visit his sister, and he mentioned and to help take care of his sister. She was not religious. She had been a professor here at says Berlin University, et cetera, et cetera. So if I'm not mistaken, Kamenetsky records how she told Shapiro that he how upset she was, or if Aaron had a great mind, he always could have been a mathematician. So he goes to Minsk, where he's with his uncle. And his uncle sends him to learn. There's a yeshiva in a place, we pronounce it Krinky, at least that's how I always pronounce it. It was headed by a great Rav named Rav Zalman Sender Shapiro. In his day, he was a great Rav. I don't think today anyone really remembers him, but they do remember his son, someone who we should have classes about. His son is the great Rav Avraham Dov Ber Kahana Shapiro, no relation to me, who was the rabbi of Kovno. He was the rabbi. He actually, some people think he was killed in the Holocaust. He was not. He actually died during the, he wasn't killed by the Nazis. He dies a natural death, just like Chaim Moshe Grodzinski dies. But I would assume his death is hurried because of the difficult circumstances. Anyone who've read Rabbi Oshri's book, Responsa from the Holocaust, or the Hebrew version, Imam Makim, knows about the Kovno Rav, Rav Dov Ber Shapiro. Before coming to Krinky, Rav Zalman Sender Shapiro, he had been the Rav in a place called Malch. And there's a yeshiva in Malch. Today it's not remembered because other yeshivas overshadow it, but one of the great people who studied, Avshal Lieberman, as I recall, Avshal Lieberman studied in Malch, Rav Unterman studied in Malch. So he's there, and then Rav Aaron's there for a couple of years, and then he goes to Minsk in 1904, where he's, at least this is the versions we're getting from Sarosky. He studies, they had this thing called a kibbutz, like a kibbutz we have today. That was not a yeshiva, but a group of yeshiva students who would gather around, Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski, for instance, had a group of yeshiva students who would gather around him, and he would give shiurim. And Rav Chiyakov of Weinberg had one of these, and when he was a rabbi in Pilvashuk. And one of the people in this kibbutz, I pronounce that the Ashkenazim do, it was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. So begins a relationship that will last for many decades. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is actually older, almost a year older than Rav Aaron. Both of them were told by Sarosky would leave Minsk in 1905 and go to Slobodka. At least that's what's recorded in Sarosky. Kamenetsky, and they both are getting this from family members. Kamenetsky has a different version. Kamenetsky says that prior to going to, he says he's in Minsk. He goes then to Slobodka, but not to study in the Musar Yeshiva. There are two yeshivas in Slobodka. Actually, at one time there were three yeshivas, but two major yeshivas because there was a split. One is known as Knesset Yisrael. That's the Musar Yeshiva. That's the yeshiva of the Alter of Slobodka, Rav Zvi Finkel, a portion of which then goes on Aliyah and is established in Hebron and to this day exists in Jerusalem, known as the Hebron Yeshiva, the two different branches. However, there's another yeshiva which broke away. It's called Knesset Beis Yitzchak, and that's Baruch Meir Leibovitz. That's the non-Musar yeshiva. And he says, Kamenetsky says, that Rav Aaron spent less than half a year to in Knesset Beis Yitzchak. Sarosky does not mention this at all. And then he comes to Minsk. The problem is the dates don't work out. I don't know if Rav Aaron was ever in Knesset Beis Yitzchak. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, but something's wrong with the dates. The reason is because we Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg in 1905 leaves Slobodka Yeshiva. He gets a rabbinate. And however, before that, before he leaves, Rav Aaron Cutler was in Knesset Yisrael. How do we know that? We know that because of a letter from Rav Aaron Cutler and also a letter from Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, and also an unpublished interview which I have, which has not yet been published. We know that they were connected, and further, and Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg even says that Rav Aaron Cutler was one of his bachrim, and he talks about him. What does that mean, one of his bachrim? The way it worked in Slobodka is that an older bachur, an older student, would take like a younger student under their would take younger students under their wing. So I mean, how is it? You can't. No, Kamenetsky knows about the letter, so he says that Rav Aaron Cutler must have come from to visit the Knesset Yisrael Yeshiva when he was at Knesset Beis Yitzchak. But that's impossible. That's not what he means. He and in fact, in the interview, he says he remembers him from Knesset Yisrael. So I'm not. I don't know. I mean, he could have been a Knesset Beis Yitzchak, but he definitely was at Knesset Yisrael earlier than both Sarosky and Kamenetsky speak about, because I mean, he refers to him as his bacher. In fact, Yitzchak Weinberg really leaves the Slobodka Yeshiva in 1903. He just comes back for short times later than that. He goes to the Mir. Okay, it's not that important exactly the dates. Here, as I showed you, is the picture right here of what Rav Aaron Cutler looked like during that time. Very dapper. I think you've all seen pictures of the students at these yeshivas, what they looked like. They didn't look like people look today. First of all, you couldn't have a beard if you were a yeshiva student in those days. Second of all, you didn't wear black. They were white, they were gray. The Rosh Yeshiva wore black. For some reason, Kamenetsky doesn't identify who these pictures are. I had to ask him who they are. Anyone's interested, I could tell you. Usually on the inside cover, it tells you who they are. He doesn't tell you where he got this picture from either. But I have the names of all the, I have the identifications of all these people. Maybe next class, maybe in order that I'll tell you who they are. He goes to Slobodka, Knesset Yisrael, either in 1904, 3, 5, whatever the year is, and he remains there for 7 years. And of course, he's born in 1892. So we figure he gets there 13, 14 years older, 13 years old around, what year did I say? Yeah, 1891. So get there when he's 13, 14, something like that. But after 7 years, he's ready to get married. And Rav Aaron says, as recorded by Sarosky, that when it was time for him to get married, he's completely in the reshus, that is the control of the altar, Nosson Sfi Finkel, head of the yeshiva. This reminds me of Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg. Those who read my book might recall that Rabbi Weinberg, who was given this shidduch, this marriage, which didn't work out, years later he writes that he was forced into it because of the altar and his parents. So the altar had that sort of control. In Rav Aaron's case, however, it makes much more sense. He had no parents, so who would take control of finding a shidduch? And it is Rav, so it would be the altar of Sabaka Nosson Sfi Finkel. And who was the shidduch with? Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer's daughter. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, one of the greatest Torah authorities in the Lithuanian yeshiva world. Last semester, we had classes on Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. I encourage everyone to listen to them. As we will soon see, although they are both great Torah scholars, when it came to philosophical perspectives, or I should say political philosophical perspectives, they are quite different, the two of them, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer and Rav Aaron Cutler. In fact, it is regarding the relationship between Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer and Rav Aaron Cutler, the description of it, that is what I think is responsible more than anything else for this book to have been banned. Not only was it banned, it was burnt. There's a yeshiva in Israel, Lakewood East, they call it, the branch of this quasi branch, I guess you'd say, of the Lakewood Yeshiva. And I am told, not just I'm told, this has been recorded at the time during the dispute, that the grandson of Rav Aaron Cutler burnt this book at a book burning. Can you imagine? They bought the book thinking it's going to have stuff to say about their father, their grandfather. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, I have to say that the book, although Kamenetsky denies it, and I know Kamenetsky subsequently, the first thing he said to me when I first spoke to him, it actually is great. We had never corresponded, never had any contact, and then the controversy breaks out, and there was all these talk about the book being banned. And I was on this listserv, and you know, all these people saying that it's impossible, they don't believe it. Every time these rumors happen and people say it can't be true, it is true. And that the letter of the Gedolim that came out, it had to have been forged, they didn't sign, all these. So I figured, you know, everyone's talking about this, giving their thinking, why not get to the source? I made a phone call, and someone, it happened very quickly. Within a day, I was given the phone number of Rav Nassan. He at the time, he was in Los Angeles. He was there, I believe, for some medical treatment. So within a day, I reached him, and immediately he told me, of course it's banned. And it's funny because all these people were saying they were, quote, defending the great Gedolim, that it's impossible. They couldn't have banned it. They must have been. And he says, no, they did ban it. It seems to me that every time these bans happen, and people say it couldn't be real, it turns out to be real. But the first thing he said to me, basically, when I told him I said I want to ask him about some questions about the book, and first I want to find out, is it true that it was banned? The first thing he said before we discussed anything is he said he apologized. He says, since you have the book, I have to apologize to you for using your picture of Rabbi Weinberg without asking you about it. So that's the first thing he said. So I said, it's fine with me, but I mean, it would have been nice if he would have asked me, but it's fine with me. But if you've read the book, there's no question that Rav Aaron Cutler does not come out looking so great, I should say. It does. I can't help but thinking, even though Kamenetsky denied it, I asked him straight out. He denies it. I get the sense that he has some, at least unconsciously, some negative feelings about Rav Aaron Cutler. Maybe there was some tension with his father. I don't know. All I can say is I understand why people in the Cutler family found this book problematic from their perspective. I'm not saying it's deserving of a ban, even from their perspective, with the exception perhaps of the one passage I'm going to read you, but I understand. And what I'm going to tell you about now is not the only passage that rubbed the certain way. But I do think it's perhaps this one passage in the book that is responsible for it being banned. This is a passage that was when the New York Times, you can just Google this, the New York Times had a whole article about Nelson Kamenetsky and the banned book. They pick up on this. So let me tell you about the passage. And let me just read it to you. This is on page 802. And this is from the original version. So Revaron, as we just said, a shidduch is made with Rav Zal Meltzer's daughter, and they're not with each other, so of course they're corresponding. I don't know today in those circles if you're allowed to correspond or this or that, but the correspondence in those days was acceptable. Quote, a reliable source reported, this is Nassim Kamenetsky speaking, a reliable source reported that Rav Aaron wrote a letter to his fiancée of which her father, Rav Zalman Meltzer, disapproved. When it was shown to the altar, that is, when this letter was then shown to the altar of Sobotka, he rejoined, quote, I did not tell you that he, namely Rav Aaron Cutler, was a tzaddik. I said he had other qualities, but he will yet become so from that everyone will suffer from him. And I think it's this passage that is the reason which the Cutler family was so outraged that led to the burning of the book. Well, first of all, you have the altar of Sabatka saying that I didn't tell you that Ravar, when I made the shidduch with you, I didn't tell you he's a tzaddik. I said he had other qualities. What that means that he's telling him that he's a great lamdan, he's a great mind, he's great in learning. Now understand that when the altar says, I didn't tell you he's a tzaddik, this doesn't mean that when you refer to someone as a tzaddik, today you might think if you say someone is not a tzaddik, it means he's a mechal Shabbos, he violates Shabbos or something like that. That's not what it means at all. If you look, for example, at the great rabbis pre-war in Europe, you would say about the Chafetz Chaim, he's a tzaddik. No one is going to categorize, you know, the other great rabbis that we think of, that's not the characteristic. They're tzaddikim in the sense that they observe Torah, but they don't have this, when the altar says he's a tzaddik, it means someone who you can't help but be impressed by his personal characteristics, his midot, his chesed, all these sorts of things. So it's not as bad as someone who's not, doesn't know the lingo might think it is, but still, I mean, we have an expression, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it. You still don't go around saying that someone's not a tzaddik, but whatever he's saying, I didn't tell you that he's, so here he's writing to a girl, even though it's his fiance. And the implication, I think, is that these are love letters. That's how the New York Times took it. That's pretty much how everyone took it, although as we'll see, Kamenetsky says that he never intended this to be understood to be love letters, but what other letter that he's writing to his fiancée would maybe trouble her father? You could say your father shouldn't be troubled if they're engaged. Why shouldn't they be writing love letters? But you could see in the yeshiva circles where the idea of love coming after marriage, that a love letter would be problematic. Although if you recall the classes on the Nazir, we spoke about the Nazir with David Cohen, where he clearly was in love. And he kept his fiance's picture on his desk, so there's room for that as well. But that, so the idea that Rav Aaron was sending love letters, that the altar of Sobotka says he's not a tzaddik, and that the altar of Sobotka also saying that he's going to become so frum that everyone will suffer on his account. These are all three put downs of Rav Aaron, cited by a quote reliable source. This is enough, even if there wasn't anything else in the book about Rav Aaron, or about any other great rabbi, and there's plenty of stuff about other rabbis also, even if it's true, whether it's true, I'll speak in a minute, this is enough to make sure the book was put under the ban. Now, when it says that the altar saying he's going to become so frum, everyone will suffer, again, the word frum means something different then than it means today. Today, the word frum is used as a synonym for religious. It's a neutral term. However, in pre-war, in traditional Lithuanian culture, which doesn't really exist anymore, maybe it exists in some of the yeshiva circles, but I don't even know even there. But in pre-war Lithuania, the word frum was a negative term. In fact, there's, I've said this a few times, there's a the word was taken to as an acronym that from in Yiddish is feel rishis, a lot of evil, venig mitzvos and few mitzvos. And there was an expression that a galach, namely a priest, is from. A Jew is erlich, a Jew is a mensch. So the word from was used, and it's still sometimes you can use it this way, but in general it's used just as a synonym. You ask, are there any from people who live there? So when the altar is saying that he's going to become from, it means people who wear their religiosity, who are trying to always create chumras, do things like that. So three put downs. In the second edition of the book, Kamenetsky tries to soften this. He wants to let you know that it wasn't, first of all, it wasn't love letters. How he knows it's not love letters, he doesn't know, because no one knows what's in the letter. He was just told about the love letter, was found objectionable. I shouldn't say no one knows about the letter. His widow, who I still knew, I knew Rav Aaron Cutler's widow, although I couldn't speak to her, but I knew her daughter. Because I was the waiter at we had this hotel in Staten Island. I've told this story on other times. Simcha by the Sea, when I was in high school, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. I don't remember if I was in 9th grade. I worked as a waiter there almost every Shabbos. And Ravar, this was owned by a man named Rabbi Newhouse, who passed away. And he was a student of Rav Aaron Cutler from the early years, one of those early students. And he, for his business, opened up this catering facility that people would come for Shabbos. And you'd have Sheva Brachos there, you'd have Bar Mitzvahs. And whenever it was open like 3 out of 4 weeks a year, for 4 weeks in the month. So whenever there was a simcha, and since he was already making food and everything, Rav Aaron Cutler's daughter, Rebbitzin Schwartzman, she was divorced by from her husband, the Rosh Yeshiva, of Dov Schwartzman, would come together with her mother, who at this age was in her 90s, and you couldn't really talk to her. And a Polish woman who was her helper and took care of this. So, I mean, even those days, we're talking 1982, 1983, you couldn't speak to the mother, Representative Schwartzman's mother. But today, no one knows, obviously, what's in these letters. What does Kamenetsky say? So, one of my great regrets is that I was her waiter. Pretty much every week she was there, because Rabbi Newhouse thought that I should be her. He liked me, because I knew about Gedolim and things. Didn't know as much as I know now, but I knew a little bit, and I used to learn with him on Shabbos. I was the first one to ever learn with Rabbi Newhouse, so he liked that. So whenever the Rosh Yeshiva and the people came, and Rabbi Schwartzman once came at the same time that his ex-wife was there, that was something. So he would always introduce me to the rabbis who would come. And I was the waiter for the so, but I didn't speak. Only later on did I learn about what an interesting woman she was. She went to Columbia University. She was getting a PhD. This is Rav Aaron Cutler's daughter, because the girls were allowed to go to university, getting a PhD in political science. She never finished, but she was also a delegate to the Democratic National Convention from New York. She was involved in politics. Oh, if I knew then what I knew now, I would have the whole Shabbos. I would have. And talked to her about all the history and everything. Instead, I just served her food. So Kamenetsky, in the new edition, the second edition, he says that he conjectures that the letter concerned an impressive hasbara, an impressive explanation he had delivered. Kamenetsky's writing, it's hard for me to believe that even he believes what he's writing, but he wants to save the book. He says that he thinks that Rav Aaron was bragging about, the way such a good explanation he explained to all the other students, a Tosfos or something. This doesn't fit, because the Alter's reply is that Rav Cutler is not Rav Aaron is not a tzaddik, and becoming from, his frumkeit is going to cause all of us distress. That's the sort of thing you would write if you saw if a guy is speaking to a girl. You say he's not such a tzaddik. What do you want from me? He's a great Talmid Chacham, but he's not such a tzaddik. If he's bragging a little bit about how he understands, a passage in the Gemara better than the other students, it doesn't really fit, and it certainly doesn't fit with saying that in the future his frumkeit is going cause of all of us pain. You can imagine if a guy is speaking to a girl, so he's not so frum, you could say, don't worry though, Rav Isser Zalman, in the future he's going to be so frum, forget about not talking to girls, he's going to make us all suffer. So I don't think that it fits. My opinion. And then he says that he gives another a report is that Rav Aharon had suggested that his fiancee read a certain book, and that's what upset Rav Isser Zalman. Again, that's possible too. Maybe he suggested that he or she read Pushkin or something. I don't know. Also, the last sentence where he says he will yet become so frum that everyone will suffer from him. In the second edition, it reads, his frumkeit will yet become so great that everyone will suffer its brunt. It's similar, the same thing, but taking away he doesn't take away the passage about the, he take away the thing that he will become a tzaddik. He doesn't say that. I didn't tell you that he was a tzaddik. That he takes out, and he lets you know he doesn't think it's a love letter. Okay, I don't know. What I can tell you is that, and I wrote in a review of this book, is that this, it's very problematic to cite this passage that Kamenetsky did. And this is, he had to have known that this is going to be a bombshell passage. This is being very controversial. And in this example, and in other examples as well, he doesn't name his source. It's a reliable source, a source who wants to remain unnamed. Now, that's acceptable in journalism. We do this all the time, but I don't think it's acceptable really in scholarship, especially why. If you know you're going to be challenged, the veracity of this is going to be challenged. I understand why the person didn't want his or her name to be mentioned, but I think in such a case, you're obligated to name the source in order to allow the reader to judge its reliability. After all, if the source is Rav Aharon Cutler's daughter, then that's a valid source. But throughout Kamenetsky's book, his book is full of X heard from Y, who heard from Z. That is, he's quoting something he heard from someone who's repeating from someone who heard from a third person. That you can't rely on that at all. And those sources should never be cited. In my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I have all sorts of quote juicy stuff, which I did not include simply because it's a story that I heard from someone who heard from someone. But that can't be justified. That's not real evidence. And then this is an example. If the source is not willing to go on the record, this is not, I think, the sort of passage that can be cited without more evidence, I would say. Okay, well, they do get married, and it's a very, from all evidence, it's a happy marriage, it's a long marriage. And Rav Aharon then comes to Slutsk, where, as we know, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is the Rav of the city, and he's also has the yeshiva there, the Rosh Yeshiva there, where he teaches in the yeshiva, and he assists his father-in-law in running the yeshiva. And his father-in-law had great respect and love for Rav Aharon. If you look even in the Evin HaAzel, Evin HaEzel, however you want to pronounce it, we spoke about how to pronounce it in the classes we did on Rav Isser Zalman. He even cites, if you look on the Hilchos Avadim, he cites a long passage, a long explanation from Avaron. And that's what, and so Avaron is part, and it's a yeshiva's work. He's married in now, and he's part of the yeshiva. During World War I, there was fighting in Slutsk. And then the communists take over. And the yeshiva remains in Slutsk during the communist era, yet can't remain for long. In 1920, the communists confiscate the yeshiva building. And further, so there still is a shul because religion is still legal. It always was legal in the Soviet Union, and the students would learn in the shul. But it was illegal to operate a yeshiva, and therefore it became difficult to offer classes. This had to be done in a when no one when you know, it became very difficult because you also had, a shul is a building that anyone could be coming in. And just because you see a guy who's Jewish comes in, it doesn't mean anything because the biggest problem the Jews had in those days was not from the official communists, it was from the Jewish communists. who were informing and who were Yiddish speakers and who many of them grew up in the very same town. So you could have private learning, but to have it was difficult. And it's obvious there's no future for the yeshiva students. So the decision was made to move the yeshiva out of communist-controlled Soviet Union to a place called Kletsk, which is right over the border. I'm going to show you now, if it's still on my screen. Let's see if I can get to my screen here. I think you can see my screen. Let me try to, there you go. So you see Slutsk and Kletsk. It's not far, 92 kilometers. Now the border would have been right around here where you see my cursor going. And in those days, now let me get my screen back up here. I want to get my screen here. In those days, in the early years, it was very easy to cross the border. So they decided, and there was a nice Jewish community there, they decided they'd move to Kletsk. And what we're going to pick up next class, I see I've already, I thought I'd go to 9:50, then I take questions. I'll stay on answering questions and discussing. Beginning next class, we pick up with Rav Aaron Cutler. There still remains Rav Issa Zalman in Slutsk with students. But Rav Aaron Cutler goes to Kletsk, and although technically it's supposed to be really the same yeshiva, he becomes a Rosh Yeshiva on his own, and it becomes his own project, and he's able to make a yeshiva in his own image. So we're going to pick up next class with Rav Aaron Cutler moving to Kletsk. And the Lakewood Yeshiva is Slutsk, which then becomes Kletsk, and then comes to America and Lakewood. So let me go back and deal with some of these questions and comments. I'm sorry I went too longer than I thought. Meiselman tells us that one of the current Rosh Yeshiva or Malkiel's relatives is in Mexico City. They go there, they raise money there. When I was there, I was quite surprised that these Syrians, who are not really Nacharedi types, but they come for a week there, but it really shouldn't be surprising, and because the rabbis of many of the shuls in Mexico City are from there. Meiselman says the implications are Bichayak of Weimar is one of the Gedolim of Sabbatki Yeshiva. No, no, it's not that he's one of the Gedolim of the Sabbat. Oh, I mean, if you say he's one of the Gedolim who graduated, sure, sure. If you look at the great authorities who came out of Sabaka, Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Wunderman, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg is obviously up there. Meiselman, who's very much involved, and I know him in library studies, tells us that it's likely worth $3,200. He borrowed it from the Library of Congress General Stacks. It went for more than that once on eBay, I think. But Moshe from Lakewood tells us that Rav David Karliner's brother-in-law was a Pinnis. Yes, his brother-in-law was Yechiel Michal Pinnis, who was an open-minded, I guess one of the religious maskilim, a big Talmud Chacham, open, very open-minded though, but very much in a traditional world. You had big Talmidei Chachamim who were, I guess you say liberal, and he goes to Israel, Eretz Yisrael, and has all sorts of problems. So that is correct. Moshe tells us about Zalman Sender's father was no pusher, Rav Leibola Kovner. Yes, Rav Leibola Shapiro of Kovno. He's known for certain things, but one of the things perhaps affects us all in that last Shabbos. Let me tell you something very interesting. If you look in the book, thank you, Moshe, it just came to me. There's a book, Toldos Ir Kovno, I think that's what it's called, and it tells the following. Last Shabbos, we read the Ten Commandments, Aseres Dibros, and the minhag of Yisrael for hundreds of years is that you stand up for the Ten Commandments. And no one ever had any issues, no one had any problems with this. Then this is quoted in the response of Yaakov Kostro. He has a whole response. Some people might come to the conclusion that the Ten Commandments are really the only thing that's important. And we know that in the days of the temple, you had sectarians who thought that this was the only thing that was divinely given. And therefore, the Ten Commandments just were taken out. It used to be part of the regular prayers, and they were removed so people wouldn't have this. And the Rambam says you cannot stand up because we don't give special privilege to the Ten Commandments that people would think that they are well, that they are above the other things. Now, many people understand this to mean that the Rambam is saying that we'll assume that the Ten Commandments are more important than other parts of the Bible. And if you look in the 13 principles, in the eighth principle, he also says that the whole Torah, even the Timna is a concubine, you know, these apparently unimportant verses that don't think, you know, that they're all from Shamayim. But I think this is, and I make this claim in my book, I think this is a misinterpretation. The Rambam is not saying that neither in the 13 principles or in this responsum that the problem with standing up for the 10 commandments or in the 13 principles is that you're saying that some verses are more important than other verses. On the contrary, the Rambam believes that the 10 commandments are more important than Timna as a concubine. The 10 commandments teach philosophical truth. The 13 principles are more important than other things. What he's saying is that when you speak about different levels, he's speaking in terms of holiness and sanctity. That every verse in the Torah has the same holiness, the same sanctity. So even Timna as a concubine is the same sanctity as Anochi Hashem, I'm the Lord your God. So when the Rambam is saying, and this is, there's no question in my mind at all, this is how you have to read the responsum. When he speaks of different levels, he's speaking of sanctity, not importance, because the Rambam himself believes that certain things are more important than others. So the Rambam says that by standing up, you'd think that the Ten Commandments, you know, that they have a higher level of sanctity than other things. So for the Rambam, every verse, even the last eight verses, have the same level of sanctity. Therefore, Rav Ovadia Yosef began a crusade that you can't stand up, even though this is the practice also in the Sephardic world. So in many Sephardic communities, they stopped standing up, and this started influencing the Ashkenazic communities. I can tell you in my town, I asked over Shabbos in the big shul, they stand up, they do the regular minhag that everyone does. But in the little shul that I go to, not sure, whatever, the people have a problem with it. So what they do is they tell people to stand up at the beginning of the aliyah. So you're not standing up. Now, I didn't listen to this. My son and myself, no other person, I didn't stand up. What do I need to stand up? Because that's not the minhag. The minhag is to stand up when you get to the Aseret Dibros. So I stood up at the Aseret Dibros. I don't think you need to change the practice. Moshe Feinstein was asked about this, and he said, no, we stand up for Aseret Dibros. But in any event, what I said so far is correct with one exception. I said that this all begins with Rav Ovadia Yosef, or the Rambam through Rav Ovadia Yosef. But if you read Rav Ovadia Yosef's responsum in Yechaveh Da'at, he tells us, because he wants to find some sort of precedent as well, that this idea that you shouldn't stand up for the Ten Commandments was independently arrived at by none other than Rav Leibel Kovner in Kovno, where he too told people not to stand up. Of course, no, as far as I know, no one listened to him. But this is not only the Rambam. And since Moshe, you mentioned Rav Leibel Kovner, that's one thing that he preceded the current knowledge of of the Rambam and Rav Ovadia Yosef. He too told people. We have people in my town who are descendants of them. The name is, there's at least one person from my town listening right now. So I'll tell you the Landos. Dave, the late David Lando and his children, they are direct descendants of Rav Leibel Kovner. So I told them that the one thing that their great grandfather is famous for is this telling people not to stand up. Weizmann tells us that the Dvar Avraham dies in the Warsaw Ghetto. He does. Not the Warsaw Ghetto, the Kovno Ghetto. Yes, he dies. He wasn't killed. So that means he was able to be brought to Jewish kever. I haven't been to Kovno, so I don't know where his grave is. And he had a son who survived in New York, and I think one in Canada. Moshe says that Professor Rieger recounts the book about published by his daughter that he's forced out of the friendship due to the altar. We know that the altar tried to control, no question about it. The Rishami Iwoi is indeed the Rishami Iwoi is the he was the Rav of Slabodka, the person you mentioned, Yosef Simonovich, who was an opponent for the Slabodka Yeshiva. So okay. Let's see. Someone makes good points here. Moshe himself points out before I said it that frum and frumkeit had negative connotations. So thank you, Moshe, for that. Meiselman knew the expression as well. Now, Moshe point says, and I repeat this for people who are listening by tape. It's interesting for me to note regarding love before marriage, I was told by quite a few mechanchim educators that Rav Aaron himself told them to explain the premarital love and kiss between Rachel and Yaakov as analogous to someone kissing a Sefer Torah. There's a story where Jacob and kisses Rachel, so it's a problem because granted, it's before the giving of the Torah, and it's before any rabbinic prohibitions, but presumably you're taught that they followed, or at least that's generally what's taught. They followed these things even prior to it. And what's, if Yeshiva Bachar today wouldn't dream of kissing his fiancée, what's Rachel and Yaakov? So it's always been a problematic, for day schools, they never know what to do with that passage. And so he said that, but this is different. This isn't about love or anything or even affection. I think most of the issue is the halachic problem. That's really the issue that, because I don't know if love before marriage would have been, I mean, it could be problematic, but that, I think that's really the issue with the halachic matter. Meiselman asked me if I know what happened to the marriage between her and Rav Dov Schwartzman. I can tell you I spent a whole Shabbos with Rav Dov Schwartzman, and all I did was ask him questions and schmooze with him. Not these sort of questions about Gedolim, because I didn't even know these things. I asked him questions about Torah, halacha questions. Again, a perfect example, had I been able to ask him questions about history, it would have been something. Supposedly, the story is that Rav Aaron Cutler, he used to come every summer to Jerusalem. I think it was the summer he came, because he also was the unofficial or the official head of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva of his father-in-law, even though he wasn't involved with it because he was living in America. He'd come there, he'd come a lot to visit his father-in-law, and then he'd still continue coming. Apparently, one day he comes to Eretz Yisrael. And he's very impressed by this Rav Dov Schwartzman. Incidentally, he goes to Rav Dov Schwartzman after Rav Shlomo Gorin. He wants Rav Shlomo Gorin to be his son-in-law. Wait to hear about this. So he just gets someone who his whole life is in yeshivas, has no secular studies, has no knowledge outside, you know, the four cubits of the yeshiva world. And you already heard what I told you about his daughter, who's going for a PhD, who's involved in democratic politics, very wide-ranging. From someone I know who was in Lakewood in the 1950s, the explanation I was given was that the daughter was much too worldly. She's growing up in America. Even if you're growing up in Lakewood, you're growing up in America. And here is someone who his whole world has just been within the four cubits of the Aled Amos of the yeshiva, that the marriage, it wouldn't work. In other words, the wife was too advanced culturally. That's how it was explained to me. I mean, there might be other reasons. What I tell you now is just my impressions. And I'm talking about a woman who was in her 70s at that time. She wasn't the easiest person to talk to. She was very demanding. Rav Schwartzman, you speak to him, and it's like, the way he wasn't just speaking to me, he's speaking to all the waiters. He's like the most friendly person. You have to pinch yourself when you realize he's a great Rosh Yeshiva, that all he wants to do is shoot the breeze, the easiest person to speak to. And it could be that personality-wise, he's such an easy, calm person, and she was maybe more of a stringent type. It could be that. Again, that's That's just one weekend with Rabbi Schwartzman. Couple other things before we end. Meisman says the Rambam is referencing Karaites. No, it's not referring to Karaites. There weren't any Karaites in the times of the Talmud. Take a look at it. He's not referring to Karaites. Referring to sectarians from the times of the Talmud. Okay, say by Tosin, you say. I guess you corrected yourself. Moshe says that the practice of standing for the Ten Commandments always bothered me, and you were happy when you found out it was a label covenant view. Well, we also stand for Az Yashir, or at least that's a common practice. Well, I don't know why it would bother you. There is something special about the Ten Commandments. 613 commandments were not given at Har Sinai. 10 were given. I asked my son this Shabbos, how do we know there's 10? If you look at it, it doesn't say 10. You have to look later on, both in Shemos and Devarim, where it does mention 10, and it doesn't call them Dibrot. I don't know why it becomes Aseret HaDibrot in Chazal. If you look in the Chumash, it's not Dibrot, which sayings, I guess it means. It's Devarim in the Chumash. But I don't know, Moshe, answer this question. Why should it bother you? Clearly, there's something special about the Ten Commandments. They were the ones mentioned, the others weren't. So there's no implication by standing that you're saying that the others are not Minat Torah or anything or Min Shamayim. It's just that you're acknowledging there's something special about these. So, and that's the justification. That's why everyone responds to the Rambam. Before the Rambam, I mean, a thousand years, let's say, 2,000, however long the practice is, the Rambam thought it's a problem. But look in Eastern Europe, we don't have any sectarians. In fact, I think it's the Chida, if I'm not mistaken, who says that the concern about sectarians doesn't apply. Or maybe it's Rav Moshe Feinstein, because we don't have sectarians like that anymore. Are we actually getting, do we have sectarians who say that the Ten Commandments are the only things that matter? Actually, maybe we do today. Today, the reformer, the conservative, some of them might say that the important thing is to follow the Ten Commandments. So maybe today we do have sectarians. But in Eastern Europe, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 400 years ago, you didn't have anyone coming around saying that the Ten Commandments aren't are the only thing that's important. So, okay, so I raised the question, Moshe. You can email me about, and we can next time class we can begin and why you have a problem standing up. Meiselman says Rav Aharon supposedly wrote in a letter that Garunchik had the best time learning. I'll talk about it. I have the letter, or I have a letter, never been published, complete letter, but I have the section of the letter I'll show you about, and I'll show you a picture of Rav Aharon Cutler together with Rishlomo Goren. To be continued. I thank you all for joining me. We'll see you next class, next week, hopefully, again, I think from Scranton. So good night, everyone. And if anyone has any comments or questions, please email.